Welcome to another Monday. On the overhead is the distribution of total scores on the exams. Several questions have been asked. I'll try to answer them. The first is, how do you get your total score, since we didn't add it up for you? You take the number correct on the Scantron, not the percentage, number correct, add it to the number of points total for the three essays that were graded, and add those up, and you get a total which ranges from 30 to 67. And what this means, this is the kind of distribution we will do after each exam, except we'll keep adding them up. And when we get to the third one, so you have your total points plus the writing exercises, everything that you've done, we'll have your total for all of that. This is only for the exam. So if you did the earlier writing exercise, which was worth 1, 2, 3 points, you can add that, and it would give you your score at this point. And right, so we get a total. When we get to the end of the course, we'll have all of those points. They'll add up to a possible 200 and something or other, 250, 260. And there will be this long distribution, and it'll have some gaps in it like that. In this case, the average was about 50, so 49 something, or 50, which is almost identical to the average for the first exam for each of the last 3 years. So you're smarter, but I'm not doing as well. Right? That's what that means. If the average is the same each year, it means that you're smarter and you should have done better, but I'm not doing as well, so your score is the same as theirs. That's one interpretation. Okay. So if you're way up here, you did fine, and you need to keep doing what you did. And if you're down here, you need to review what you did and do something different. If you're in here, take your pick. Okay. If I had to assign grades, if they told me the university is closing on Wednesday for good, forever, but the registrar wants a grade for this course, it's not. And I don't want to start a rumor. Okay, we will be here. Then I would say, this is an A plus, these are A's, these are B pluses, B minus, I mean B minus C. You get the, that's the pattern, that's what happens. Okay? So the percentage of points that you got out of 71 makes no difference. So don't even worry about it. Don't calculate it. The only thing that's important is how many points you got compared to the other people in the class. Okay. Strictly competitive. Now, how to do better. First thing, do the writing exercise, which is an analysis of your exam and your performance on it and your preparation for it. How many of you, I know some of you have, because you've already turned it in. How does that make the rest of you feel? Okay. It's on the website. The instructions are on the website. Follow them. Follow the instructions. It means that you have to take your exam, Scantron, with you. The exam is posted outside C-150 during C-150 Living Learning during office hours. Anytime I'm there, it's up. Or if somebody else is there, it's usually up. And you can go through the exam, figure out which kinds of items you missed, why you missed them, and connect that to your preparation. And what we want is not the right answers. We already know those. What we'd like to have is your analysis of what you learned in looking at the items that you got wrong compared to the items that you got right. and your thoughts about how you could make your essays more complete and more accurate and more responsive to the question, and then what you will do differently next time. And so there's a planning component. What will you do next time? There are suggestions about what to do in the syllabus, on the website, study tips, separate page for that. And then, of course, some of you already know what you should have done that you didn't do, like the reading, the come to class, those sorts of things that may be obvious, but it's helpful to plan that that's what you're going to do for the next exam. Turn in your analysis, which needs to be typewritten, 1.5 or double-spaced, along with your exam responses, your Scantron and your essays, so we can see if we sort of agree with your interpretation of what you did. And we will give those back to you. And the exam analysis is worth up to 8 points. A couple of people have raised a question about reading your Scantron. Okay. On the Scantron, down the middle column, or the middle, yeah, right here. Right. There. And these are the item numbers. These are the answers. If an item is wrong, the correct answer is printed beside the item. Okay? So this refers to that item. This refers to that item. Okay, so there are no examples of the confusing ones. Yeah. There. That correct answer refers to item 21. This one refers to item 46. So it's the one that is beside the item. A couple of people came in and said, I don't understand why I got this one wrong. Why is that? You know, that's why. You didn't. It refers to the item that is on the same line, but they only print down the middle. I don't know why. I didn't invent it. We just have to use it. Questions? So I put you on the spot. Are you? Will you? What? Yes, you'll be available after class in Living Learning. That's not on the spot because that's on the syllabus. Are you going to do a study session?
Yes.
You got an audience. Okay, we'll find a place. Okay, great. And we'll put those on the web. We'll also send an email to everybody. Okay? Those are focused on study skills specifically for this course. They're not review sessions. It's just how to go about absorbing the material as best you can and respond to the exams so that you demonstrate your knowledge of the material as best you can. Okay. Other questions? All right, good. Thank you. Back to language, which is what we were talking about. And I had suggested that we can think of language as a system that lets us represent the knowledge that we have in our heads, and in representing it, put it out there for somebody else to hear or to read, and to create for them an understanding, a congruent meaning that, if we're communicating well, matches. So it's a way of bridging the gap. The fact that we don't have Vulcan mind meld, we can't just get the meaning from one head into another. It has to go through some transformation process, and that process, one of the many processes that we use for representing our understanding, our meaning, is language. It's not the only one. There are many different kinds of languages. I had made the point, I think, that language depends on having shared meaning of something that we are both referring to. I think the last point I made before we demonstrated our alphabet skills, which you were very good at, is that referring to something starts with gesture. We point at things. We are the species that is famous for pointing at things. We look at things and we interpret each other's looking as directing our attention to whatever the other person is looking at. Human beings are a very visual species, and we are able to tell where somebody is looking sometimes. We can tell so well, it's kind of, we wish we didn't know where they were looking. But we can tell, and it's a useful skill, because if you're driving down the road, you glance at another driver, a driver who perhaps should be looking at you or your vehicle, you can tell quite easily whether or not the person is looking at you or your vehicle. And if the person is not looking at you, if his or her eyes are not directed at you, you know the person is potentially unaware that you're there, and therefore you'd better turn on your defensive driving skills because you may get clobbered. We can tell in a room full of people whether other people are looking at us. And I think I made the point that we've all had the experience of walking down the street and seeing somebody looking at something, and we direct our attention in the same way. Infants do that. Infants do that as soon as they have control over where they're looking. As soon as they develop the eye musculature, they will direct their gaze where somebody else is looking. They're a little slow at it, and they're a little inaccurate at it, but they can certainly tell whether you're looking at them, and they like it when you're looking at them, and they don't like it if you're looking someplace else when you're face to face with them. They get annoyed. They get irritated that you're not looking at them. So there is something built in to the species that has been useful over the millennia. Knowing whether somebody's looking at you, and then knowing where somebody else is looking, and then the huge accomplishment intellectually that leads to the ability to use language. Huge accomplishment is the recognition that when somebody says something, they are referring to a particular thing. The notion of reference is critical. All words refer to some aspects of experience or connections among ideas, some quality of experience, some idea. And semantics is the study of meaning. What is it you are referring to when you use the word gediddlehopper? Or yo-yo? What is it that you're referring to? As kids begin to learn language, a couple of things happen. One is that we see them beginning to understand what words mean, what they refer to, long before they can produce them. Receptive language, as we call it, the ability to hear the language and figure out what somebody is referring to, comes along way ahead of productive language. So while kids are still grunting when they point to something because their articulatory mechanism is not good enough to pronounce a word that we would understand, their auditory mechanism is excellent. And their brain is processing the specific languages and sequences of words that we use regularly with them, connected to their referent. So kids will follow directions long before they can give directions verbally. Annie? Yeah. Good question. Let me sort it out a little bit. The question is, when babies are using sign language, which we now know we can teach babies quite well, does that speed up their abilities to produce vocal language? No. Probably not. But what it does do is demonstrate that language is built in to the brain and that we can process, we can create language vocally from what we hear or gesturally. We can actually figure out what the sign is, what the symbol is, a specific movement that refers to a particular thing. Usually things are the things that we first learn to symbolize. And what we've discovered is that people who can't hear and people who can't speak have the same language learning ability, except they create their language in motion rather than in sound, which gives some support for Gardner's notion of multiple intelligences, right? Because what it says is most of us use an auditory linguistic system for creating language. That seems to be the one that we have evolved. But that system of creating meanings, symbols for meaning, and rules for connecting them, grammar, that system can be applied to movement as well. So instead of being an auditory vocal language system, you can create a visual movement language system, and they are learned in the same way. So it says the brain has this system, Chomsky calls it a language acquisition device, and it's somewhere in the circuitry, in Broca's area probably, and that device can take spoken language or gestural language and process it in the same way. And in both cases, it requires first the connection, the referent. So even if you can't do one or the other, you might be able to do the other. And the fascinating thing is we don't know how many more there are. Is there a touch? Can you do touch and create a language from touch? Is that input processable in the same way so that you could create a touch language? Helen Keller did, but that one was based on spelling. So we've got this device. And Annie's question is, does using it in one area speed up development in the other area? we don't know. We really don't know, because we have so few kids who go far enough, so few hearing kids, kids who have both an intact visual system and an intact auditory system, so that they're learning both languages simultaneously. And to do a comparison on their usually fairly limited vocabularies. And if you have deaf parents, but you're hearing? No. Okay, your friend is hearing. So your friend is bilingual and uses both languages and learned both languages. I've known a number of people who grew up bilingual, and one of the languages is American Sign Language. Whether their linguistic abilities develop faster than other kids, we just don't have enough data. What we do know is that in general, knowing more than one approach to language and more than one language increases your linguistic facility overall, so that if you're learning four or five languages, spoken languages, as a child, I'm watching a not quite two-year-old who's being exposed to five languages at home and among his relatives, and he's learning them all, I can't believe it. I struggled with one, I got the first one okay. English is okay for me, or American, but the other one, Spanish, Latin, German, Italian, they're all total failures on my part. But in his case, my guess is that he will develop a very good understanding of linguistic processes and appreciation for them, which is typically what happens for multilingual kids. His father, talking with his father, trying to figure out how many languages his father knew, and he'd never bothered to count, and he got up to 9 languages that he can speak and understand. He grew up in a household where there were 5, I think, himself, and then he's learned more along the way. And the mom speaks 4, I think. She grew up with 3, so there's some overlap. The person I knew with the best, and I'm going to put this in context in a minute. I maybe mentioned I went to college, there was a professor there who was a linguistics professor, and his goal academically was to learn one language, to be fluent in one language in each of the major language groups, of which there are, I don't know how many different language groups, there are over 5,000 languages spoken, and he was up to 17 languages that he was fluent in, and he just learned one a year. By going in the summer, as soon as school was out, he would go immerse himself in some new language, live in it, read it, talk, spend his entire time. Now, the point I want to make is that language acquisition device is very powerful in infancy and toddlerhood. And it becomes more narrowed the longer you speak just one language. Its plasticity, its facility decreases. And if you only learn one language as a child, it's harder to learn. The older you get, the harder it gets to learn another language. And the process of puberty, I think I mentioned this maybe, the process of puberty reduces that facility dramatically, particularly the ability to learn language as what we call natively. So to absorb it, to understand the grammar without going through a translation process. Little children do that easily, as this not quite two-year-old is demonstrating, learning the grammar in 5 languages, unrelated languages. So we, of course, in the United States, teach one language to kids, and then after they go through puberty and their brains have solidified, we try to teach them another language. And they struggle with it and they don't learn it very well, which is why we're a monolingual culture. Most of us only know one, and not even sure how well we know that one, but there we are. The more you learn as a child, the less solidified your brain becomes at puberty. You keep that language acquisition device active, and the more you learn as a child, the easier it is for you to learn new ones after adolescence. Which is why we should be teaching second and third languages to young children and elementary school kids. Aha! And you don't want me to step on it, because when I go and fall on my head, we're going to discover how brittle my bones are, and I don't want to do that. Thank you. Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah. Would touch language be considered Braille? No, but it would be the basis for that. The reason it's not is that Braille is a direct, as I understand Braille, it's a direct translation of letters. So, but it does require processing the letters differently, but Braille is not a symbolic language. It's a translation. What I envision is a language that would be based on the way you touch, that there would be a particular touch for a particular meaning, word. And if you ever run into one of those, let me know, because while I occasionally claim to know everything or pretend to, I really don't know whether anybody has ever done that. And it would be interesting. An interesting test of the facility or the power of that language acquisition process, and a nice test of Gardner's multiple intelligences. Okay. So there are much to learn there, and I went too far into that topic, more into that than I wanted to, but one more.
When would you start teaching a child a second language? Would you create a base first? Like, do you want to teach English first and then teach second language Spanish?
The question is, when would I start teaching that second language? Watching the kids that I have watched grow up tri or quadrilingual, I would say it doesn't matter. Start as early as you can. My other favorite example is Desiree. I met Desiree when she was about 9 months old, and she was walking. And the day that I met her, she was on one of those folding chaise lounges, webbing, and she was walking on it. Okay, and that impressed me, because she wasn't putting a foot down through the webbing, and she was barefoot. She wasn't putting her foot down through the webbing and getting caught up in the webbing. What she was doing was much more interesting. She was walking past the fulcrum point, the leg, to get the whole thing to start tipping up. And she would go just as far as she could and tip it, and then she would back off. And then she would turn around and she'd go the other way, just get past the fulcrum with her weight, tip it up, and giggle, and come back. And I thought, motorically, this kid is to be watched. Her parents taught her to ski downhill in Vermont during her second year of life. And I lost track of Desiree, but at one point she was ski racing and doing ballet and all kinds of wonderful motor skills. But the thing that I enjoyed most was that her father was Hungarian, her mother was German, and they both spoke English. And she was learning all three languages. And I went to dinner one night at their house, because the mother's mother was visiting for several months from Germany, and my German back then was actually not too bad. It's all gone now. And they had invited another friend who spoke Hungarian. So there were a bunch of people around the table, and there was my first wife, who didn't speak any foreign languages except English, which was foreign to her. And, excuse me. And so we're sitting there, and three languages are running around the table in different combinations with different people. So I'm struggling in German with the grandmother, and the mother's bailing me out occasionally, and the father's speaking Hungarian to his friend, and Desiree is watching this whole thing. Desiree was at that time just past three and a half. And what I'd noticed about her language was that she would use English and Hungarian and German words and grammar all together. She was learning one language. And it had the vocabulary of all three, it had the grammar of all three, and I thought she was making a good case for not teaching multiple languages because of all the mistakes that she made, which you could understand if you knew which languages she was learning. So at the table, she's watching, and finally there's a lull in the conversation. Actually, everybody had eaten so much dessert and had so much wine that nobody could move or talk except Desiree, and she got the whole, everybody's attention. And she said in her wonderful, nice voice, in English, she said to me, "You talk this way." And I said, I was trying to figure out what she meant. And before I could figure it out, she looked at her mother and said to her in German, "And you can talk this way," but she said it in German correctly. And then she looked at her father's Hungarian friend and said to him correctly in Hungarian, "You talk this way." And then she looked at her German grandmother and said, again in correct German, "You only talk this way." Which was correct. Her German grandmother only knew German. And after that, the rest of the evening and all the time that I was with Desiree and her grandmother and her mother and her father, she differentiated the people and which language they were most comfortable in. So she stopped initiating a conversation with me in Hungarian. Yeah. She would only speak to me in English. And she knew my German crap stunk anyway. And she would only speak to her grandmother in German. And she spoke to her mother in all three languages, because her mother was really fluent in all three. But what I had been privileged to watch, one of those things you just would have killed to have it on film, because you could have used it the rest of your life instead of trying to get you to understand the picture of this. If I had had it on film, I could have been rich and taken her around. What I was privileged to observe was a child differentiating the three languages that she was learning. And then once she differentiated that, they were separate systems for her and they were attached to separate people. And she could use them correctly. What she ended up with, last I communicated with her parents, she was fluent in five languages. She'd added French and Italian to those by the time she was through high school. And I think represents the fact that the more language experience you have and the more diverse that is, the more you keep that linguistic ability alive. And she certainly demonstrated that. There was another... Yes? I'm sorry. The sign language is a language. American Sign Language, French Sign Language are symbolic languages. They have gestures which are arbitrary. They refer to concepts, and they have grammar. And that defines a human language. That is arbitrary symbols. That is, it's not this means goodbye, or this means I don't like you, but they have symbols. Gestural symbols, which are just simply conventions. They've been agreed on that that's what you will use. Some of their symbols are, this is a duck. There are things like that. You have to know about ducks to be able to do that. But many of them are just simply not there. They're completely arbitrary. Fun thing, how many of you know ASL? Yeah. It's really cool. How many of you have tried to learn it? Yeah. What did you learn? Probably the same thing I did, which is that in all of my life, I have never had any experience at processing the information that is used in ASL. Finger position, finger movement, hand movement, hand position, and trying to process it while protocol says, don't look at the hands, you know, look at the eyes, look at the face, because there you're getting the emotional information that goes along with it. And it's fascinating to try to do that because most of us have absolutely no experience processing, making sense out of, and putting together the gestures that are the medium for American Sign Language. We started off as infants listening, and we're really good at that. But figuring out where somebody's going with their hands while they're doing it very quickly, it takes a long time, and it's well worth learning if you have the opportunity to communicate with somebody who uses it. Okay, I'm going to go back on track. And not that that's not important, it is important stuff, but I want to go back to the language ability has evolved as one of the skills. And Noam Chomsky, a professor at MIT, who was reported recently, who was it? Oh, Chavez, the president of, what's that country we don't like? Nicaragua? Cesar Chavez told the United Nations that they all should read Chomsky's book, and regretted that Chomsky was no longer alive, so he couldn't talk to him about it. Chomsky was amused. He is still alive. He is still teaching at MIT, and he said, I'm happy to talk to you about the book anytime you want. The news of my death is premature. What happens, I'm going to go back to some of the comments that I made about the brain. We are designed to process particular kinds of patterns. And, you know, the fact that there's an object out there and it is moving, we attend to that. We distinguish the object from its action. We distinguish one from more than one. When we put together narrative sequences, we know what happened first and what is happening now and what is about to happen sometimes. Whether something was before or after, whether something is real or fantasy, whether it's a fantasy that has real potential or not. Cause and effect, what's inside and what's outside, negating something. All of those are schemas about our experience in the world. We know about one thing being smaller than another, they're being the same or bigger. All languages reflect these universal patterns. What we've learned to do is process the information, create the schemas, and then attach words. So we can refer to those patterns with words. These are words, and you know what they all mean. You have the schemas. And all languages have those schemas, except that some of them don't pay any attention to some schemes, so they don't develop a pattern or a grammatical rule or a form for a particular scheme. And some languages have much more complex schemes to represent in some areas than in others. So our languages differ, and sometimes you can't translate because you don't have the vocabulary or you don't have the concept in one language that you have in another. But if you were a linguist, in the middle part of this past century, 1950s, we were still trying to figure out how to talk about the differences among languages. And one young maverick at MIT, linguist, had one of those, you know, you wake up in the morning and it's a day that sort of isn't like any other because you're thinking through the night about the problems of language. And Chomsky had one of those days where he was talking about languages and how they're alike and how they're different. And he'd been talking about it for a couple of years and was puzzled, as everybody else was, about that connection between the brain and language. And as he began to think about the evidence that he'd seen about children using linguistic forms that they had not been taught, seeing children produce language that they'd never heard, watching children invent words, he began to develop, and it developed very quickly for him, the notion that grammar, the rules of language, the ways you put the words together, that which frustrates us so much in eighth grade, grammar is really the rules for changing your meaning. Grammar is the rules for transforming the words that you're using to change your meaning. And you go back to the first overhead with the utterances from one head to the other. So what's important is the meaning, the original kernel of what you were trying to express, which is based on your experience. And you learn the words, but the grammar, changing words, is how you change your meaning. And that's what language does. That's why it has grammar. So that we will know how to change our meaning in specific ways. And what the brain has is the transformations, the relationships, before and during and after. It doesn't have the language for that. It has the rule for that, the potential for a rule. That's what the language acquisition device is. It's the potential to have language to express a particular relationship or change. And he came up with the notion of transformational grammar. Grammar that changes the meaning, transforms the meaning of what you're saying, and I'll illustrate that in a minute. Grammatical rules are the directions for generating or changing our utterances to reflect specific differences in our meaning. This is on the web, so I hope you're not frantically copying it down because I'm about to yank it off. Okay. Children abstract the rules from the language they participate in. That's why kids learn the grammar of their specific language, and they learn it without being taught except by example. As children construct each element of the grammar, they get a particular rule. They can generate infinite examples. They don't know the rules, but they recognize when they are violated. They can't tell you what the rule is, but they can generate appropriate speech. And they learn the rules and apply them, and then they learn the exceptions in their specific language. They over-regularize it. They want it to be regular. They want us to follow the rules. And in many languages, everybody follows the rules. And the languages are easy to learn because the rules are always applied. And then there's English, which has so many exceptions that it's almost impossible to learn, especially if you come from a language that you've already learned that is regular and doesn't have exceptions to the rules. We have all of these rules. We have exceptions for spelling, I before E, except after C, or when sounded as A, as in neighbor and way. Right? You have to learn the whole thing just to get the exception so you can spell when the combination is C, E, I, or I, E. You have to know how it's pronounced. Yuck. Adults provide the experience. If you talk to kids, you're giving them the examples. If you talk with them about things that you are experiencing together, talking about what's happening to the table, talking about what the child is doing, encouraging the child to talk back to you, then you're expanding the child's language. And that's what the kid is learning from. And that's what's necessary. Sitting in front of television won't do it unless it's Sesame Street. And you can actually learn something from Sesame Street. But it's not enough because Sesame Street won't answer your questions. You ever tried? Ernie, pay attention to me. Doesn't work. You need an adult who will pay attention to you when you say, Dad, pay attention to me. When you expand and correct what a child says, you're refining the schemas. You're refining the rules. Okay. What do I mean by transformational grammar? Okay, here's a word. Okay, baby. Y'all, you got that one. Sleep. Okay, so I have in my mind some kind of meaning about a baby and sleep. If you have a young baby, you don't get to sleep. If you have a young baby, you want the baby to sleep. You cheer silently when the baby is sleeping. And one of the ways you can transform your utterance is to tell the idiot who's making too much noise to be quiet because baby is sleeping. Okay. What I just did was contemporize that, as I made it right now, and I made the sleep a verb. Okay. Sleep is not a verb, it's a noun. But sleeping is a verb. And it's present tense, especially if you put that, whatever that's called, in here. So baby is sleeping. Okay. But if I want to tell you the state of the baby, then I say it differently. Baby is asleep. Now that's a really strange statement, right? The baby is asleep. Okay. Have you ever seen a sleep? You've had a good night's sleep? But now I'm telling you the baby is asleep. So I've got one baby that's asleep, and I've got another baby that's a nap, and I've got another baby that's an elephant. I don't know. But I know that this is a single word, and I've created a whatever part of speech that is by adding asleep. And I can do others. Awake. I can be on board the train. I am aboard. Strange thing to say, I am aboard. But I have a grammatical rule that says if I put A in front of the verb or the noun referring to the action, then I can create a new form. What if I have two babies are asleep? I have a grammatical rule. I pluralize that. And if it's a Y in English, I change it to IES. Okay, so the babies is sleeping. No, they're not. The babies are sleeping. If I pluralize the subject, I have to pluralize the verb. I can still go back to either of these. They are sleeping or they are asleep. You have in your head probably more than 1,000 grammatical rules that you can apply anytime you want just to express your meaning. All right, idiot, you made too much noise. The baby was sleeping. Now the baby is awake. I hope after you leave, the baby will be asleep again. After you leave again. I'm now talking about a conditional desired future, and I've created a narrative sequence. I can't say, before you came, I hope the baby will be sleeping. Right? Before you came, I hope the baby will be sleeping. I can't do that because I have before, which puts me, now I've got to have something that happened, and now I'm present. I hope the baby will be sleeping before you came, that the time is all screwed up. So it's ungrammatical. I have to be able to say, before you came, I was hoping the baby would stay asleep. And after you leave, I hope that the baby will be sleeping again. Yeah, those make sense. What linguists have been doing now as they study children is looking at the forms or structures of the grammatical rules and demonstrating that children know the general forms independent of the content. So they can apply them. They can recognize that curious green ideas sleep furiously is a grammatically correct statement. Curious is an adjective. Green is an adjective. Ideas is a plural noun. So curious green ideas, while it's a little strange, is grammatically correct. Sleep is a verb. So now I have a thing, ideas, sleep. It's a general statement. How do they sleep? Furiously, of course. That's an adverb. It's grammatically correct. We could write papers about it. We could probably write a book about it. We're not going to do that. We also see that something can be correct and quite ambiguous. So Jill reported the shooting of the hunters. What have I got? She heard a noise in the woods. So is the crime they're hunting on posted land? Or do I have a homicide? Did somebody shoot the hunters? Well, if they were hunting on posted land, perhaps they did. Once you acquire a rule, you can generate infinite examples. Okay? This is a wug. Here are two bugs. You add the S. Okay, you can do that. So can two-year-olds. I love to flag. Last night I went flagging. Right? Tomorrow I will flag furiously. You can generate them. Let me give you a real example. This was one of my favorite daughter, the pediatrician. Right. I didn't do this one yet. About the sofa? No. Indeed. So here's Gwen. She wasn't a pediatrician then. She was three. And she was climbing over the sofa in the living room, over the back, from behind it, and toppling down onto the seat. And then she would go back. And this was very difficult, in part because it was a Victorian sofa and it had a kind of sharp wooden carved back thingy up there that she was dragging her fat little tummy over. And she was huffing and puffing, and Daddy was sitting across the room reading the paper, sort of enjoying time. And she was narrating her life, as smart kids will do. It's one of the tests for smart kids. Smart kids tell you constantly what they're doing. Now I'm going to the kitchen. I'm going to get a drink. I like to drink. I have... That's my immediate test for smart kids. Smart kids know language, and they use it, and they drive you nuts. And they continue to do that. So here's Gwen going over the back, and huffing and puffing, and working up a sweat. And she's describing for me what she's doing, and she occasionally would say, "Look, Daddy." So Daddy will dutifully look. And there she goes, over the back. And she says, "This is hard. This is hard. I'm good. I do it well. I'm strong." You know, all those self-confidence, self-concept stuff. And I'm agreeing with her, of course. So she's going back and forth. And she's trying to not be boring, so she wants to change her representation. And she wants, you know, I've been doing this a long time. This is hard. It's not easy. It's hard, especially from the back. I can do this. So she's going on and on and on and on. And finally she said, "I'm getting tired. I do this with, and my ears perk up, because what I've just heard is a grammatical form. I do this. She could have said, well, that's not what she meant. What her meaning was that she wanted to get across was that this is hard. This is hard. And she generated this stem. I do this with, okay? So she knows how to describe an action and its quality. She's got the word with. And now she's stuck. What do you do? She's generated it. She's got the form. She's stuck for vocabulary. She's stuck. What would you say? What? Make something up. But what would you say? I do this with... Huh? Skill? It's hard. It's hard. Effort? It's not easy. Difficulty. That she didn't have the word. She knew it was hard. So she said, I do this with hardens. I do this with hardens. The hesitation is while she's trying to figure out a word that means the same thing that she's doing, but she doesn't know difficulty, which would have been easy, so she knew it was hard. She knows the rule for converting the state to the noun. Hardens is a noun. I'm independent. I do it with independence. I'm vigilant. I do it with vigilance. The A-N-C-E or the E-N-C-E ending is required by the with. You've got to turn it into a noun. You've got to turn it into a noun. It can't be an adjective. It's got to be a noun. And the way to do that, it was generative. It was creative. It was what everybody does with language, as we're always just on the verge of stumbling over our grammar. And she created a word. And we still use it in the family, because once a three-year-old invents a word, you've got to use it, right? Especially if she's so skillful. Okay, I want to talk about differentiation and integration briefly. This is an example that lets us talk about that. This is actually an example from Piaget, which he uses to talk about the illogic of four-year-olds who will come in the door and announce to you that it's raining because I brought my umbrella. And he uses it as an example of egocentrism, and I offer it as an example of the necessity to differentiate the grammatical forms, because I don't believe this kid actually believes that it's raining because she's carrying her umbrella. If anything, as you all know, we all know superstitiously that if we bring our umbrella, it won't rain, which is why we bring our umbrella, right? It's like walking down the street, snapping your fingers. Why are you doing that? Keep the elephants away, right? That's absurd. Well, it works. See any elephants? Okay, that's a superstitious behavior. What she really means, it's raining, so I brought my umbrella. Or, it's raining, that's why I brought my umbrella. She knows the cause and effect connection between rain and umbrellas. She also knows that there are three different ways to talk about cause and effect relationships, because she's heard her parents and other people talk about cause and effect. Why did that happen? Because this happened. Why does this happen? Well, it happens so that something else will happen. And that's why we do that. We do that so something else will happen. Okay? They're all causal words. Because tells you the connection between cause and effect. So is another one. and that's why. They all refer to cause and effect. So what the child does is lump them into a category that says cause and effect words. I've got a category. So anytime I want to talk about the causal connection between two things, I can pull out any of those. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is that cause and effect is directional. The cause causes the effect. So you have the cause, so you get an effect. You have a cause, that's why the effect happens. Because is the opposite. Because the umbrella, it rained, so I brought my umbrella. It rained, that's why I brought my umbrella. It rained because I brought my umbrella. It's the reverse. I brought my umbrella because it rained. It's an opposite. It's not in the same category, and you have to create a different category of cause and effect that includes because, and that's the opposite way to say it. So if you start with the cause, it's raining, then you can't use because it makes you look egocentric. It's raining, or superstitious. It's raining because I brought my umbrella. It's the reverse. The child has to differentiate those two directions for cause and effect and understand that you use because in one case and you can use so and that's why in the other case, but they're not interchangeable. They're not interchangeable. So what you have to do is differentiate the meaning of each of them. That's the semantic piece. And then you can integrate them into your speech appropriately and into your thinking. But it's not enough to just accept that they're interchangeable because they all refer to cause and effect. They don't. They're opposites. Okay. What does language do for us? Well, it bridges that Vulcan gap, or the human gap. I can't know what's in your head. I can't know what your experience was. I can't know what you're thinking unless you can speak it to me or write it to me. Language lets us share our experience with other people. It lets us share experiences that we have not in fact shared. We haven't done them together, but we can talk about them. It lets us refer to our thinking, not just our actions. As we get older, we can understand the process of thinking that we've gone through. And it lets us transcend time and space. Daddy can go to work, and when he comes home, we can tell him all about our day. And he can tell us about his day. Maybe. Language lets us create or stimulate ideas in other people. We can say things that other people haven't thought about. We can explain things, and maybe they will understand them. We can transform our meanings or our understandings. And we can also generate for ourselves completely new ideas. You ever play that one of those games, there are a number of versions, where you get a script, but it's got blanks in it, and you randomly pull nouns or verbs or adjectives or adverbs out of a hat and fill them in? No, you don't play those games. They're fun. Yeah, you do them. Okay. You can generate, have you generated wonderful ideas, wonderful concepts? Language can do that for you because words have meanings, and when you hear them, you can generate a new idea. a 20-pound marshmallow. Now, to set the stage for Wednesday, we're going to talk about Piaget. And I'm going to give you the 5-minute version of Piaget. Okay, here's the 5-minute version of Piaget. Piaget described 4 stages in knowledge, acquisition, and construction. And he started with babies on the floor, engaging in actions, and learning all about the world with their sensory motor skills. And they are developing a huge repertoire of knowledge about how to do things, how things work, where things are, how to make things happen. They're learning about volume, they're learning about relationships of cause and effect, but they're learning them on an action level. They're learning them with their bodies. And they can pretend them. So before the baby can talk to you about sleeping, the baby can take her book and put her face on it and pretend to sleep and know that she's kidding you. Or she's telling you, I want to go to sleep, before she can say that. She can do it in action. She can represent her understanding in actions. Then a magical thing happens in the middle of the second year. Some changes in the brain have been working, and the idea of reference begins to take shape. And sequences become grammar. So the child is now able to continue to learn about the world sensory-motorily, but adds to that the ability to represent it linguistically. So now, in early childhood, the child is representing 2 stages, sensory-motor plus language. So the experience, the understanding that she's developed through her actions, she is now able to represent in words. She doesn't stop learning from action, but she adds the ability to describe it. Then another shift happens. We called it the 5-7 shift when we talked about the brain. And the words and the concepts and the sequences get organized into what Piaget called the concrete operational abilities of the school-aged child. The school-aged child can put the words and the concepts and the sequences and the grammar into relationship with each other and create classifications and categories and talk about them and think about them using a new kind of intellectual skill, a mental operation, which he calls concrete because it still has to refer to things that have been experienced. So the school-age child is now representing 3 stages all at the same time, 3 levels of skill, 3 ways of representing the world, 1 in action, 1 linguistically, and then an organized logical way. You're not replacing the skill, you're adding a layer to it. And then we go through another significant switch called puberty. And we add the ability to think about abstract systems or relationships of relationships. And we use a different set of intellectual skills called formal operations. They're mental operations, but they are not about the substance or the concrete content of the classifications we were using, the baseball cards or bottle caps, or breeds of dogs. They're now about the shape, the form of those classifications. They're abstract. They're independent of content. And after you consolidate those about the time you finish college, that's all they wrote. There is. That's all she wrote. You're not going to get any smarter. You're just going to add more content and more experience and more fluidity and more coordination and all that. This is Piaget's theory. Duh. We start with our sensory motor skills, we add language, we organize it into concrete relationships, and then we can think about abstract relationships. And that's really all there is. When you look at the exercises, right? Remember the exercises? This is not a tease. We are going to start with them on Wednesday. But think about what you have to know, what you have to have experienced, what words you have, how you have to put them together in order to answer any of those problems. And I've got 2 more minutes. What should I do with it? Answer questions? I should let you go. Okay.